Direct from the city that lives by night. This is Thomas DJ, author of the Shadow Legion books, and you're listening to the Quarter Bin Podcast.
This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book for my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 128th episode of the Quarter Bin, we are looking at the last days of the Justice Society of America special, from DC Comics, cover dated 1986. Just 1986. But first, a little feedback. On episode 126, Time Walker, we heard from Laurel Phillips, a.k.a. Mountain Flower One. Dear Professor Allen, just listen to your coverage of Time Walker number one. I bought this off the shelves early in my comic book collecting. I had never heard of Valiant, but it looked cool, and it was still a thing for me to buy number ones in 1994. Ah, yes, when we were young and foolish, Laurel. I happily found Ivar to be the Devil May Care rogue the little text box describes him to be on the first page. I'm getting closer to my age, starting with a 5, but I'm not there yet, and I could make out that really tiny text. Well, once you've crossed that threshold, Laurel, we'll be glad to welcome you to the elite fraternity of the Starts with a 5 Club, and don't expect to be able to read that tiny, tiny print at that point. Laurel says she was surprised that I didn't make more of Ivar's quirky personality. I was also surprised you left Gil out of the story altogether, since he was key to rescuing the scientist from the Nazis, plus was involved in the time travel, who did what, when, in what order, that you say you like. I would think you'd include him. Maybe you have an issue from some alternate timeline and Gil isn't in your copy of the book? Thanks for another enjoyable episode. Really loved the follow-up info on Dakota North as well. Keep up the good work, Laurel. Now, my whole family met Laurel at Heroes Con over the summer, and she is a total sweetie pie. So when she says that she was surprised about me missing those bits in that issue, what she really means is that she was disgusted and angered, but is just too nice and southern a lady to put it that way. I understand, Laurel, and I will try to do better. Always good to hear from you, and I'll try not to disappoint you so much next time. Though I do like that time travel excuse that she provided for me. I'm definitely going to use that one at some point in the future. Or will it be in the past? On episode 127, we talked about Spidey and Captain Britain as they appeared in Marvel Team-Up 65. Sir Martin of Grey commented, as he often does, commented on the music. What a lovely show. Background music-wise, something lovely and Brit patriotic. Would have been Choss-like. Now, I have no idea if those last three words are typos, or if that is actual Scottish lingo. Whatever it was, I assume he meant that he would have preferred Brit patriotic music. Martin does disagree with me on Braddock and Jameson. I'm not convinced that that was reasonable for Brian to suspect Spidey of being a baddie due to Triple J's rants. New York City papers were unknown in the UK. Jameson would have no influence here at that era, whereas Spidey's good guy exploits would have been covered by UK reporters based in the US. That's a reasonable, I suppose, Martin. Except that I think after just one day in New York, or even just the few hours that Brian has been in the city, I'm pretty sure JJJ would still influence such an impressionable young Brit. I mean, maybe. Martin also added that Arcade made a big impression in Marvel long before Avengers Academy, having fought the X-Men a fair few times. I always thought Arcade was meant to be a ventriloquist's doll from the way he looked. And that is one of those things that I never thought of, but as soon as Sir Martin said it, it made a lot of sense, and I would not be surprised if that's the way that his look was intended, that is what it was intended to convey. Randy Watts twittered that he remembered this issue, and Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond called it an excellent issue. And we heard from Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks. Good professor. Well, another character I know little about besides how he looked in the 90s when I had his trading card. So with basically nothing to say to you about Mr. Braddock, I'm going to touch on an element of Spidey that you brought up which can tend to annoy me. Wait, Nathaniel Wayne annoyed about something he read in a comic? Shocking. Spider-Man has pretty much always been my favorite superhero, Nathaniel says, and he's definitely one that different fans can have different feelings about depending on when they came into the franchise. I've never liked the sad sack Peter that most fans of the 60s and 70s issues love so much, and relatedly, I tend to take issue with his epic bad luck. Now, Peter's lousy luck can function well. For me, it plays out best when it's tied to consequences of his actions. Peter will make a choice, and then basically ends up with some of the worst consequences. Heck, that's the entire origin of the character. What I don't care for is when his bad luck is basically just tied to coincidences that move the plot forward. Peter having to put up a visiting Brit who just happens to be a hero, that is just cosmic tomfoolery. Or more to the point, it's kind of lazy writing. I know that many comic book stories depend heavily on coincidence, with characters meeting by chance and the like. But I think it bugs me with Spidey more because of how many fans defend or dismiss this as just Parker luck. Nope. Sorry. It's still lazy writing. Hey, look at that. I got right into the buskill groove without missing a beat. That is certainly the case. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne. And actually, now that he mentions it, there are a strange number of characters in comics and in sort of fantasy sci-fi fiction with powers or personalities that are based on luck, mostly good, but not always. And I do think it does make it easier as a writer if you've written yourself into a corner, having one of those characters, and whether they have good luck or bad luck, it does come in really handy plot-wise. Chris Ouellette from Bizarre Manor heard me lament the lack of a discount on that book as it had only a 35-cent cover price. In an attempt to cheer you up, Professor, I thought I would remind you that the Federal Reserve is eroding the value of our money. To equal the value of 1978's 35 cents, you would need $1.36 of 2018 money. So by using a current devalued quarter to purchase a comic with a 1978 35-cent price means you picked up that comic at a discount of over 80%. Though, aren't you a professor in this field? And I'm just a guy with a bachelor's in theater arts, speech, and film? Maybe I should stick to story analysis in my emails. Hey, Chris. Stay out of my area of expertise, okay? Even if you are, in fact, you know, correct. Dr. Ange added that Arcade was part of the Claremont Burn X-Men run. For me, he adds, his most memorable appearance was in the Goodwin Chaykin Nick Fury Wolverine special. I do like this Captain Britain costume, Dr. Ange says, more than the RoboCop one we got in Excalibur. I just didn't like that costume on any grounds, but I guess when it does come to costumes, there is always a worse one out there for any character, I think. Those episodes received social media love from Gene Hendricks of Two True Freaks, Christopher J. Warden, Jim the Canada Daredevil, Ed Moore, Al Sedano, Bill Baer, Sir Iowa's Joe, Paul the Book Guy, Old School Ross, Luke Giaconetti from Earth Destruction Directive, Chris from Bat Books for Beginners and The Professor Frenzy Show, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Tim Price, Herman from Into the Weird, Paul Hicks from Waiting for Doom, Karen from Between the Pages, where pop culture and food meet, Trekker Talk, Richard G., and Michael Lane from the Kirby Cast. Thanks, everybody. I really appreciate that feedback. But we have a comic book to get to. Let's do that right now. The Last Days of the Justice Society America special had a cover price of $2.50, meaning I acquired this issue at an impressive and easily calculated 90% markdown off that original price. The cover, by Mike Gustavich and Dave Ross, shows a lot of Justice Leaguers laid out on the ground, gravely injured, maybe dead. This includes Superman, Hawkman, Catman, and there is a city burning behind them. Five floating heads are looking down at the scene in shock and horror. Star-Spangled Kid, Dr. Fate, Hawkman, Power Girl, and the Spectre. So we have a somber, morose feel from that cover. The story, just called The Last Days of the Justice Society of America, was written by Roy and Dan Thomas with art by Dave Ross and Mike Gustavich. In the interest of full disclosure, I used the issue synopsis at the DC Wikia as a starting point for the synopsis that follows. We start near midnight, Thursday, April 13th, 1945. Our narrator has no memory of a so-called bomber's moon over what remained of Hitler's Berlin that night, but if not, there should have been. But still, amongst it all, there was the bunker. A German officer named Speer takes the emergency exit into the bunker and is ushered into the presence of Hitler and a half dozen officers. "You've not yet heard," the Führer asks. "The war is not lost. Roosevelt is dead." Hitler goes on to talk about how this day was foreseen in his horoscopes over the years, asking how much proof his loyal armaments minister needs to believe. After proclaiming that the U.S. and Russians will soon be exchanging artillery bursts with each other, Hitler talks about the secret connections that he believes exists in music. Secret connections with an earlier world. He proclaims that he has ways to make sure the whole world goes up in flames should the Reich fall. Then indeed shall mankind behold in truth the twilight of the gods. We move 40 years later and half a world away. Our narrator sees proud figures, mighty figures, even the few among them who stood with the aid of a cane or sat squirming impatiently in a metal wheelchair. They had been the heroic flowers of their star-crossed generation, beacons of inspiration to all the dreary decades since. They were the Justice Society of America. In the aftermath of the crisis on Infinite Earths, the remaining surviving members of the JSA, Alan Scott, the Green Lantern, Jay Garrick, the Flash, Starman, The Atom, Dr. Midnight, Sandman and Sandy, Dr. Fate, Hawkgirl, Hourman, Johnny Thunder, Power Girl, the Star-Spangled Kid and Wildcat. Gather in the estate of Carter Hall at a funeral service for Helena Wayne and the Earth 2 Dick Grayson, whom they knew as the Huntress and Robin. Carter Hall, Hawkman, is delivering the eulogy. But no words of mine, or of anyone else, can add one iota of luster to their names, nor to their deeds, which stand on their own, need the acclaim of us who remain. And from there, he gone for about 4 pages, talking about the society's history, including the events of the crisis. A catastrophe, beyond reckoning in many ways, yet out of whose violent birth pangs this very earth upon which we stand sprung forth. He talks about the redundancies created on this earth, younger heroes, many of whom bear the same powers, even their same names, realizing that their own team has become redundant and past their time. He calls for the Justice Society to be immediately disbanded. But just then, our narrator, the Spectre, appears unto them, crying out in pain before collapsing, "I am the universe, and I am dying." Dr. Midnight admits that the Spectre is beyond his medical ability, and then Dr. Fate touches the Spectre, and Fate is immediately flooded with images of something that took place in 1945. Something that is far different from what the rest of the JSA team that was active at the time remembers. On the day of FDR's funeral, the Justice Society sees a rip in the sky, which they surmise is another reality trying to enter into theirs. The members who can fly attempt to fly into that rip to investigate, but they are soon repelled. The Spectre reveals that the point of origin of the rip in the sky, quote-unquote, is Germany, which makes the team, as well as President Harry S. Truman, realize that Adolf Hitler has a powerful, mystical weapon that he intends to use not only against Allied troops, but against the whole world. Whatever it is, the president says, can be seen and heard equally well from every known point on the Earth. It's like Armageddon. The Spectre says that there's more at stake than just the outcome of a world war. The destiny of all the Earth hangs uneven in the balance, and the weight of so much as a feather may tip the scales towards survival or the end of the universe. The Justice Society travel over the ocean and through Western Europe as far as they dare outside the limits of the sphere of influence. This is as far as some of them can go, Wonder Woman points out. Johnny Thunder understands that if they go traipsing inside Nazi-held territory, we'll fall victim to the spell cast by Hitler's Spear of Destiny. So without Superman and all the heroes with magic-based powers, the other JSAers bravely enter into that zone, many of whom are picked off one by one by Nazi troops as they enter the bunker where Hitler is using the Spear of Destiny. Starman, Wildcat, the Atom, Mr. Terrific, all gunned down. Though Hawkman and Batman survive long enough to confront Hitler, it's too late. Fire pours into the room and devours its inhabitants. And then it spreads to Europe and the whole Earth, devouring everything on it and the planet itself until nothing remains. The Spectre himself is the last victim of this act. After revealing this alternate history to the Justice Society members of the present time, Dr. Fate shows them that the rip in the sky is now over them, now in 1986. What Hitler had done in 1945 with the Spear of Destiny is now coursing its way through time. That was the end of the world, Fate says, precisely as it happened in 1945. They debate time travel theories for a few panels, but ultimately they trust Dr. Fate, especially now that he has had some extra powers bestowed upon him by the Spectre, by touching the Spectre. And this wacky weirdness and time mumbo-jumbo is sort of his specialty, at least more than theirs. And Dr. Fate transports the team back in time to 1945 in a really nice, almost full-page splash. Everyone is coming through time right straight at us. They arrive at the critical point where they see that Hitler has started using the spear to cause a worldwide catastrophe. And he reveals that Hitler has also tapped into the power of the Spectre when he was lying dormant following his confrontation with the Anti-Monitor. The culmination of all these powers were required to enable Hitler, after speaking the proper runic incantations, to bring about Götterdämmerung, Ragnarok. Dr. Fate takes the heroes to a strange city with a great stokage wall around it, perched on a rainbow and guarded by an ancient-looking warrior holding a horn. This is the DC Universe version of Asgard, the home of the Nordic gods, also revealing that Hitler has linked the fate of their Ragnarok, the Twilight of the Gods, to that of our universe. The heroes are met by the ship Naglfar, the vessel made from the nails of dead men, and manned by monsters and giants out of hell. Loki is there in the watchdog garm and bringing up the rear the most dread creature of them all, the fire giant Surtur. Knowing that the only way to keep Hitler's linkage of Ragnarok to the universe's destruction from taking place is to change the course of Ragnarok's outcome, Dr. Fate merges the members of the hero team with the Nordic gods who are out to battle the demons who've come to destroy them, led by Loki. Green Lantern and Dr. Fate combine their powers to merge the heroes and the gods as one. Starman, for example, merges with Heimdall. Fate puts it ominously: the gods cannot win the epic battle about to begin upon the mystic plane of Vigrid, but perhaps with the aid of the Justice Society, they shall not lose the battle. Starman notices that all of his teammates are, as he puts it, getting into the act. If this is the day I buy the farm, I can't think of a grander bunch of guys to go out with. If nothing else, Loki and his Doomsday gang will know they've been in one hell of a fight. In some legitimately heartbreaking moments, Flash, Johnny Thunder, Green Lantern, Starman, Hawkman, Hawkgirl, and Wildcat all perish in battle. Twilight of the gods, indeed. In his final moment, Wildcat muses about their efforts to try to change the script. As Thor, Green Lantern has an epic throwdown with a sea dragon beast and almost defeats it. But no. With only Surtur, the giant fiery demon, left to battle, the perished team members are brought back to life, and they all join together for the defeat of Surtur. Everyone except Power Girl and the Star-Spangled Kid, who have been purposely held back by Dr. Fate. As the Justice Society does defeat Surtur, Power Girl and the Star-Spangled Kid see that the whole battle is starting over. Dr. Fate reveals that the battle must be repeated over and over in order to protect the universe from the intended fate of Ragnarok. This is an eternal battle, my young friends, a struggle that can never really be finished nor fully be won. The Justice Society are like men caught forever upon a Mobius strip, whose every battle, once over, merely begins again with the same combatants. Now, all of this time over the last 15 pages or so of this epic battle Interspersed among those pages are historic scenes of the fall of the Third Reich, the U.S. and Russian troops making great progress against the Nazis pushing into Berlin. Dr. Fate transports Star-Spangled Kid and Power Girl, the youngest of the heroes, out of Asgard and back to the Carter Hall estate in the present time of 1986. The young sometimes must be spared the fate of the old, that they may live to do battle with evil another darksome day. The Spectre arrives, surprising Dr. Fate, who thought he was dead. Spectre explains that he has always been dead, and after giving a shout-out to his epic appearance in Swamp Thing 50, he announces that his day is done. Only when my last vestige has faded from the universe will the world of 1945 be restored and history proceed as mankind has known it. Thus, my master has called me home to his bosom. He tells Fate that this new, i.e. post-crisis, world is safe, thanks to Fate's efforts and the JSA's valiant sacrifices. Dr. Fate arrives at the gravesite as well, joining the Kid and Power Girl. The members of Infinity Inc. have joined and are all informed about what has transpired. As the course of his planned Ragnarok has changed, Hitler sees that his plans to destroy the world have been defeated. He marries his mistress Eva Braun, and then 40 hours into that marriage, the couple retreats to their underground suite where they both commit suicide. The end.
Evolution is a constant, even for the world's greatest superheroes. Founding members have departed. New members have stepped in to fill the ranks, and their final memories of Happy Harbor are of a stunning betrayal and the loss of their secret sanctuary. But there is only one place to go for the Justice League of America as they march into the Bronze Age of comics, straight up, more precisely, 22,300 miles up above the Earth. Welcome to a bold new era for Justice's First Dawn, a classic Justice League of America podcast. Your host, Mike Peacock, invites you to make yourself comfortable for over 100 issues and their very first annual with the League as they enter the much-beloved satellite era. Here's a brief sampling of the thrills and chills that await your podcast catcher, a veritable who's who of new members, such as the Elongated Man, Red Tornado, Zatanna, and Firestorm. Surprise membership returns, more epic team-ups with the Justice Society of America, along with appearances by the Legion of Superheroes, the All-Star Squadron, the New Gods, and even a combination of the DC Universe's greatest heroes of history. A galaxy of superstar writers such as Denny O'Neill, Len Wein, Steve Englehart, and Jerry Conway. The longest artistic run in the book's history by the astonishing Dick Gillen, along with contributions by Neil Adams, Don Heck, George Tuska, Rich Buckler, and George Perez. All this and more surprises and excitement await you in this new phase of Justice's First Dawn. Come along with television's era-certified super friends at classicjla.podbean.com or subscribe to the show via iTunes. Oh yeah, and there's the debut of Ultra. Yay!
And we're back. The inside front and back covers of this issue contain an approximately 2,000 word essay by Roy Thomas about the story in the JSA. Here are a few of those 2,000 words. This is the JSA story I really never wanted to write, nor would I ever have wanted to read anybody else's version. of the end of the first comic book hero group of all time. So why did we do it? The answer harkens back to the recent Crisis on Infinite Earths maxi series, as so many things at DC do lately. When it was definitely decided that the original Superman, Wonder Woman, and several other Earth 2 heroes would bite the dust, the feeling was strong for the JSA to retire as well. Thus, bowing to the semi-inevitable, I must confess that it was I who timidly brought the matter out into the open at a DC editorial meeting. We at DC thought the team deserved a big send-off, or at least a loving attempt at one. The JSAers were, as the saying might go, forged in the flaming fury of World War II. Somehow it seemed fitting to me that their beginning and ending should be linked somehow. But when you're dealing with stories set in the well-mapped past, problems multiply. Setting a story in the past was my own idea, but it did give me problems to solve. But as it turned out, Paul Levitz had already solved the big one. At this point, Thomas talks about the 1977 JSA origin story that Levitz wrote that introduced the concept of the Spear of Destiny to comics. When it came to winding up the JSA's career, Thomas figured it only logical that the Spear of Destiny and Hitler play important parts. He then talked about the Spectre's final scene in Crisis 10, which left him kind of a supernatural coma. What nobody realized, Thomas continues, is that the Spectre over the decades had become more and more powerful. So powerful, in fact, that while he lay in that coma between the worlds, his mystic energy reached out unconsciously back into time, perhaps attracted by the magic of the Spear of Destiny. Now, about the use of Götterdämmerung, it should be noted that I went to various sources for the adapted quotations from the Ragnarok portions of the Scandinavian prose Edda. And so the Justice Society of America is gone, presumably forever, sure. DC could bring them back any time it wished. We've all long since learned that there's no comic book death which is so undeniably final that a way can't be found for the dearly departed to rise from the tomb. But as far as Jeanette Kahn and Dick Giordano and I are all concerned, this giant-sized special signals the end of both the JSA as a group and of each of the individual heroes locked in the Ragnarok cycle. Only Dr. Fate, Power Girl, and the Star-Spangled Kid remain, and you'll see the aftermath of this special in the next issue of Infinity Inc., in which the Infinitors strive to come to terms with their private griefs. As for us, we'll have to deal with our own grief in other ways. Wow, that was an interesting read. I mentioned that this Roy Thomas essay appeared on the front and back inside covers, meaning that they weren't used for ads. As a matter of fact, none of the 64 pages between those covers had any ads either. And that's pretty darned awesome. Now, before I move on to my feelings about the issue, I wanted to go to an expert about one of the key aspects of this issue, to actual practitioner of Norse religion, and excellent podcaster and friend of the network, Gene, the podcasting machine, Hendricks. I sent Gene a copy of the issue, which he was familiar with but hadn't read, and asked him what he thought about the story in terms of how the Norse aspects were handled. And he sent this email as I like to call it, pre-feedback for the episode. Alan, last night I finished my first reading of The Last Days of the Justice Society special, thanks to your generosity. Overall, it was an interesting take on the post-crisis JSA, who really didn't fit into the world anymore. This was an interesting, if torturous, way to take them off the table. And torturous is the exact word, Gene. Perfect. For a heathen perspective, aka a modern worshiper of the Norse gods, I was quite pleased with how Ragnarok was presented. Roy Thomas obviously did his research, and any discrepancies I'm going to chalk up to either a different translation that I'm used to, or something that just worked better for the story. I also liked who the heroes were matched with. Hawkman being the chairman, and user of ancient weapons, was the perfect choice for Odin. And Green Lantern, the true heavy hitter of the group, worked quite well with Thor. The astronomer Starman was a nice choice for Heimdall, since they are both used to observing over great distances. Good insights there, Gene. I hadn't considered those matchups that closely, but clearly they were thought out. The one thing I thought I would have a problem with, knowing the aftermath of the story, was the ever-resetting Ragnarok. It turns out, though, that I'm fine with it. Oh, it has very little to do with Norse lore, which has many cycles built into it. But the story was still enjoyable. Ragnarok is supposed to be the end of the Aesir and their enemies, with a new world rising from the ashes of the old and the new pantheon of gods led by the resurrected Baldur. The version in the comic is more like what the heroes of Valhalla experience, fighting all day and feasting all night until the twilight of the gods is upon us. The Spear of Destiny and the interference of Dr. Fate and the Spectre changed all that, though. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to read this one and for sharing my thoughts on it. Now we need to find out where the JSA came back from Ragnarok and read how that was handled, Gene. Thank you, Gene, for taking time out of your busy schedule to read this. It was 68 dense pages, everyone. 68 pages written by Roy Thomas, I'll remind you. So thanks for that, Gene, and of course thanks for sharing your thoughts from your particular and specific perspective. I will point out that Roy Thomas has revisited the concepts of Ragnarok of Götterdämmerung more than once, often through the lens of the Richard Wagner Ring Cycle. He co-wrote the early issues of the Thor take on the Ring Cycle from the late issues in the 290s around 1980. He wrote about the first half of what was about a 15 or 18 issue exploration of that. And then in 1989, he and Gil Kane produced a four-part prestige format series based on the opera. So it is a story that has long fascinated him. And just to be clear, the Thor and Loki and Odin and all of those characters that appear here do not look like the Marvel versions of those characters. The characters themselves, the Norse gods, are in public domain, so anyone can tell this story or a story like it. But yes, the specific artistic renderings of the characters as they appear in the Marvel Universe are subject to Marvel's trademark. Not the story, not the characters, but how those characters look in their books. That's all that Marvel has legal rights to, just in case anyone was wondering about that. And since Gene got to talk a bit about how this story had elements based on his religion, I would like to talk briefly about the story element based on my religion. That's the legend of the Spear of Destiny. In the Gospel of John, mention is made of a Roman centurion who uses a lance or a spear to pierce Jesus' side as he hangs on the cross. There are a few churches across Europe who claim to have the spear, or parts of it, and in fiction it has become one of the legendary magical artifacts in the same category as, say, the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant. The movie versions of both Hellboy and Constantine mention the spear, just as examples. And it's always a bit nerve-wracking when something that is important to you, part of your faith or belief structure, when that is covered in a comic book form. And the spear, as it is used in DC Comics, I thought that this passed the test of appropriateness, or at least of respect. Now, a little-known fact about the man who legend says did the actual piercing, the centurion himself, the centurion Longinus. We are now firmly in the area of extra-biblical or post-biblical stories, but legend has it that Longinus eventually converted to Christianity himself and is venerated in the ancient church generally as a martyr. Feast days move around a bit sometimes, but from what I could tell, the Catholic Church currently honors him on October 16th. Now, you might be thinking that I've been talking for almost 10 minutes about this comic book here in the analysis and opinion section of the episode, and I haven't really said that much about, you know, my analysis or opinions on the issue. So to cut straight to the chase, this is really good. It's 30 plus years old, and it's written in that pre-crisis Roy Thomas style. In other words, as I've hinted at, There are a lot of words in this issue. These are 64 pages of story that are gonna take you a little while to read. To some, that might be a bug. To me, it's a feature. And the stakes? Wow. The stakes. We've got the lives of heroes at stake. We have the death of Earth at stake. And oh yeah, we have a little thing I like to call the destruction of all things at stake. And if you're going to wrap up Crisis, or try to serve as a bridge between the pre-Crisis and post-Crisis DCUs, you have to tell a big story. And this is a big story. I could see that someone who misses the JSA or who doesn't like their heroes to die, those people might not like this story. It's intense. It's sad. It's a tough read. I think that's pretty clear from the synopsis I did, but I did want to make sure that I specifically point that out. This is a rough, serious read. The art, it's not groundbreaking, but it does its part. It serves its function. For one thing, there are a ton of characters in this, and they are portrayed pretty well and pretty consistently. I mentioned the lack of ads in the issue, in addition to making sure that all 64 story pages actually contained story. In terms of the budget aspects of the transaction, there is that. But also, ads interrupt the flow of story. So in this one, the lack of ads kept that forward momentum of the story going and going and going. The story literally started and never stopped until 64 pages later. This was really good. The verdict on the last days of the Justice Society America special, counting the covers, which had content, it's 68 pages or 64 pages of story. Either way, but no ads. That by itself puts it well on its way towards being worth a quarter. And it has the great advantage of actually being really good. I don't mind intense, emotional, tragic stories. So for me, this was clearly, definitely, a quarter bin steal. A couple of things I want to mention here towards the end. For probably more than 80% of these quarter bin episodes, maybe 90%, the music underneath is by Wagner, my favorite classical composer. But because he gets a shout-out this episode from Hitler, and there is some connection that Hitler makes between Wagner's music in Germany and the Twilight of the Gods, I thought it wise to eschew that common musical choice. So I settled on my second favorite classical composer for this episode, Sergei Rachmaninoff, a Russian composer who passed away in 1943. So selecting a musician from an allied nation who had just recently passed during the time in which this story takes place, I thought that that just worked. I also want to give a shout out to a podcast that covers a lot of JSA material. I didn't play the promo for their show because it hasn't produced any new episodes since mid-2015. But if you like the JSA, I heartily recommend the back catalog of Tales of the Justice Society of America. The show is on the Two True Freaks Network, and those episodes are still there on the network website. The show is hosted by Scott Gardner and Michael Bailey, a pair of excellent podcasters and pretty fine fellows. That wraps up our coverage of the last days of the Justice Society of America special, bringing episode 128 of the podcast to a close. Next time on episode 129, it's back to our number 9 series of episodes, and we'll be looking at the Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 3 from Marvel Comics, of course, cover dated December 1994. So we'll be looking at full-length reprint stories featuring Daredevil, the Hulk, the FF, and Iron Man. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
Three, two, The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.